Owawo's Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter said the U.S.-led coalition is laying the groundwork for the isolation of Raqqa, the Syrian city viewed as the capital of Islamic State. Speaking in Paris Tuesday, Carter said the operation to assault Raqqa could overlap with the ongoing offensive to retake the Iraqi city of Mosul from IS defenders. He said the operation would rely on capable and motivated local forces.
It, as always, and this is a strategic principle of all of coalition operations, that it is capable and motivated local forces that we identify and then enable. That's our general strategic approach, because we're seeking the lasting defeat of ISIL. And a lasting defeat of ISIL can't be achieved by outsiders.
French President Francois Hollande warned the Mosul offensive, begun a week ago, could trigger an outflow of foreign fighters, a concern for European nations wary of IS-trained fighters returning from the battlefields of Iraq and Syria. Russia said Tuesday it's extending a moratorium on airstrikes on the center of the devastated Syrian city of Aleppo, although reports indicate the government assault on rebel-held districts continues. Lieutenant General Sergei Rutskoy said since October 18, Russian and Syrian warplanes have remained 10 kilometers outside the city center for a week. Gambia has become the latest African country to announce its intention to withdraw from the International Criminal Court. The Hague-based ICC has been accused of focusing the prosecutions on Africans. The decision, which refers to the persecution and humiliation of people of color, follows that of South Africa and Burundi to pull out of the International Tribunal. Gambian President Yahya Jammeh withdrew his tiny West African country from the Commonwealth in 2013. This is VOA News. The director of U.S. National Intelligence said Tuesday that the ongoing U.S. push to persuade North Korea to give up its controversial nuclear program is, in his words, probably a lost cause. James Clapper delivered his assessment Tuesday in New York to the nonpartisan Independent Council on Foreign Relations.
They are not going to do that. That is their ticket to survival. And I got a good taste of that when I was there about how the world looks from their vantage. And they are under siege, and they are very paranoid. So the notion of giving up their nuclear capability, whatever it is a non-starter with them.
Instead, he said the best that Western governments and their East Asian allies can hope for are negotiations with Pyongyang leading to a cap on its nuclear capabilities. Controversial Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte is in Japan for a three-day visit after calling on foreign businesses in his country worried about his aggressive war on drugs to leave. Referring to the criticism of a U.S. diplomat about his harsh crackdown, Mr. Duterte called on U.S. firms in the Philippines to pack up and leave, adding, "We will recover." John Kirby is a U.S. spokesman.
So we're not going to react and respond to every bit of rhetoric. We're going to continue to work at this relationship. We're going to continue to meet our obligations under the defense treaty. And despite the rhetoric, we haven't seen any policy traction behind it. In other words, there hasn't been any change.
In Beijing last week, Mr. Duterte suggested a separation between the U.S. and his country. He clarified the view later, saying he's not severing ties but pursuing an independent foreign policy. Independent U.N. Rapporteur Philip Alston Tuesday criticized the world body for refusing to accept legal responsibility for a cholera outbreak in Haiti that's killed thousands.
It refused to accept factual responsibility for the introduction of the epidemic, contested the scientific evidence on the basis of a self-evidently flawed and unjustified assessment, insisted that no legal claim for negligence could be brought against it, despite the clear provisions of the relevant treaty and its agreement with Haiti, refused to countenance the payment of any form of compensation, even to the relatives of those who have died, issued no apology, and did not do enough to promote and strengthen efforts to achieve eradication.
Haiti's severe cholera epidemic is traced to UN peacekeepers from Nepal following the 2010 earthquake. The co-mayors of the southern Turkish city of Diyarbakir have been detained on charges of aiding Kurdish militants, Gultan Kizanek, and her co-mayor colleague, Firat Anli, were taken into custody as part of an investigation into terrorism links. Venezuela's opposition-led National Assembly has opened a political trial against socialist President Nicolas Maduro a week after the referendum recall to remove him from office was stymied by the nation's Electoral Council. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Barte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, October 26th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Human Rights Watch calls on South Africa and Burundi to reconsider their decisions to withdraw from the ICC.
African states should stay with the court, should hear the needs of victims, should hear the calls by activists, and should reaffirm their support for the court and engage to strengthen the institution, not undercut it.
Elise Kepler is Associate Director of the International Justice Program at Human Rights Watch. Zimbabwe scientists unveil new heat and drought-resistant corn seeds. We'll tell you about a Kenyan entrepreneur who transformed an old mattress into a growing business, and South Sudan's president calls on state governors to work on reconciliation.
This challenging time needs people who can work. If we work together with one mind, with one word, with one heart, we can overcome all the problems that we are facing.
Vice President Salva Kiir of South Sudan. Female genital mutilation continues in some Somali communities here in the United States, and a new study finds that air pollution increases hypertension. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A Human Rights Watch lawyer says decisions by South Africa and Burundi to withdraw from the International Criminal Court will be a blow to the World Court and a betrayal to victims of crimes against humanity. South Africa announced last week it was withdrawing from the ICC, apparently due to the court's criticism for South Africa's refusal to arrest Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir when he attended the African Union Summit in June last year. Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza this month signed legislation to withdraw from the ICC. African countries have criticized the ICC for focusing primarily on Africa. Elise Kepler is Associate Director of International Justice Program at the U.S.-based Human Rights Watch. She says her organization has joined other groups calling on African countries to reaffirm their commitment to the ICC in these troubling times and to get engaged to strengthen the institution, not to undercut it.
At this point, Burundi has not submitted any kind of formal withdrawal. They need to do that with the UN Secretary General. But as you referenced, on Friday, South Africa announced that it had submitted a notice to withdraw with the Secretary General, which puts a one-year time period in which withdrawal would then take effect. This is a huge blow and betrayal, really, to victims of atrocity crimes by South Africa, which had been a global leader, really, on justice.
Well, as you said, a betrayal of victims of crimes. But at the same time, the ICC has been criticized a lot by African countries. For example, some have suggested the ICC has targeted mostly Africans.
It's true that the cases have focused on Africa to date, but the reality is that that comes about because African governments have been interested in seeing justice delivered for certain crimes in their countries. Now, it's also true, however, that the ICC operates in an international landscape that is not even. The U.S., China, Russia haven't joined the court. And they're also able to block referrals of other states that have not joined through their permanent veto power as members of the UN Security Council. That's a big challenge and a problem and something that needs to be worked on. But it's not a basis for withdrawing from the court. One needs to strengthen the hopes of justice, not sacrifice them and throw them under the bus.
Elise, do you think what's happening now with African countries, has this had some impact on the way the ICC now is operating? I mean, is there a change of policy by the ICC in dealing with Africa?
Yeah. The president of the ICC Assembly of State Parties issued a statement that he regrets the decisions of Burundi and South Africa and wants to see African states stay with the court, and is happy to engage at the Assembly of States Parties with states and any concerns they might have. I think obviously people are wondering, will other states join Burundi and South Africa? And we were part of a group of about 24 organizations across Africa and internationally who have called for African states to reaffirm their support for the court in this challenging period of the first ever withdrawals from the court, and that for states who are in fact committed to the hopes of justice, let's not forget that the International Criminal Court was created. It's the only court of its kind that can deliver justice when national courts are unable or unwilling. But African states should stay with the court, should hear the needs of victims, should hear the calls by activists, and should reaffirm their support for the court and engage to strengthen the institution, not undercut it.
We know that the issue of South Africa and the ICC stemmed from the fact that Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir visited South Africa, and South Africa was asked to arrest President Bashir, which did not happen. Some would say maybe that's South Africa's reason for wanting to leave the ICC, in addition to the fact that many African countries have been very critical of the ICC. Then Burundi, what is Burundi's reason?
I think Burundi is really its own specific set of circumstances. There's been a spiraling of abuses in Burundi's political situation and the issue of term limits and its president. There's been a spiraling abuses, and in fact, there was a commission of inquiry there, and investigators, as I understand it, who were expelled from the country after documenting abuses. So I think we can see Burundi clearly has a kind of callous interest in trying to remove itself from the International Criminal Court.
Of course, this is what some Africans have said. I mean, what people accept the fact that, yes, the ICC protects victims, they also say, look around, there are lots of victims around the world.
It is a huge deficit that justice in some countries is not yet possible before the ICC, but that's not a reason to give up. This is really the only institution, and its creation was historic. African governments were active in that role, and leaving the court is a cynical move, really, to give up on the hopes for justice.
Elise Kepler is Associate Director of the International Justice Program at the U.S.-based Human Rights Watch. She was speaking with me from New York City. South Sudan President Salva Kiir has asked the governors of the country's 28 states, which he unilaterally created late last year, to work with other political parties and reconcile their communities in order to tackle widespread insecurity. As Tito Justin reports from Juba, the president invited the governors to Juba for a three-day training session.
President Kiir opened the workshop by swearing in the 28 governors as chairpersons of the ruling SPLM party in their respective states. SPLM chairpersons are normally elected by party members. The president did not give any reason for not following SPLM rules. Mr. Kiir called on the governors to unite their citizens in the quest for peace.
I appointed you because I knew you were very serious people that I knew you will work. This challenging time needs people who can work. If we work together with one mind, with one word, with one heart, we can overcome all the problems that we are facing. This is what I want from you.
Mr. Kiir says South Sudan is a nation for all and therefore requires everybody's participation regardless of their party affiliation.
Relationship between the SPLM and other political parties. We have to intensify that work, so that, you know, instead of fighting one another, we have relations.
Jubek State Governor Agustino Jadala says the ruling party must do more to unite the different ethnic communities across the country.
The government and the party has to do a lot of positive efforts to regain SPLM strength by empowering our members in all aspects and reconciling our communities so as to create a conducive political environment and minimize the differences among the communities to enhance the security in the country.
President Kiir warned the governors against taking unnecessary trips to Juba, which he says drains state budgets. Mr. Kiir says unless he personally authorizes a governor to travel to Juba, the governors should remain in their home state.
If you want to come, ask the permission right away from there. If I permit you, Nogule Dal, because Yongede, you will meet me, you come. If I have not given you that green light and you come, then you are Manabarfuda.
President Kiir urged all 28 governors to support First Vice President Taban Dengai in his effort to fully implement the August 2015 peace agreement. This is the first SPLM induction workshop since President Kiir unilaterally expanded the country's 10 states to 28. There have been reports of fighting in former Western Bargazal and Upper Nile states over the creation of the new states as some communities resist being part of a different state. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
Today's Wednesday, October 26th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barton in Washington, and please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 15 minutes past the hour. Scientists in Zimbabwe say they have developed new heat and drought tolerant varieties of maize that may be ready for sale ahead of the next planting season. The seeds from the International Maize and Wheat Improvement Center were developed to combat drought-induced food insecurity that has affected millions in southern Africa over the past year. Sebastian Mofu visited the research station in Chiredzi in Zimbabwe and files this report.
The International Maize and Wheat Improvement Center, better known by its Spanish acronym CIMMYT, says the new varieties could play a significant role in reducing the problem of food insecurity in Zimbabwe and other parts of Africa. Cosmos Magorokosho is a senior scientist with CIMMYT responsible for coming up with the climate resilient maize strains.
I'll call them a game changer because farmers will be able to get some kind of food security if they adopt these varieties. Food security in Africa will be partly addressed through these varieties because in Africa, maize is life. A lot of seed companies in many countries in Southern Africa, East Africa, North Africa, they've shown a keen interest in adopting these hybrids because they know that they'll be working in their environments.
He said farmers in Algeria, South Africa, Egypt, Uganda, Malawi, Tanzania, and South Africa, along with Zimbabwe, have shown interest in the new maize varieties, CIMMYT, developed with funding from the U.S. Agency for International Development. Early this year, Zimbabwe declared a national disaster after about a third of its 13 million people struggled with food shortages caused by El Nino-induced drought. The CIMMYT official said the effects of that drought could have been mitigated had the heat and drought-tolerant maize varieties been on the commercial market. Apollonia Maruchaka from Zaka District, one of the driest regions in Zimbabwe, planted one of the new seeds from CIMMYT last season. There is real hunger here this year. I'm just lucky that I replanted the demo seed after the first crop failed. Compared to other commercial seeds, the demo seed sustained the heat and dry conditions we experienced. Despite the heat and dryness, I got something and I only ran out of food around February. Machaka's neighbor, 66-year-old Amon Makonese, also managed to harvest enough to look after his family after planting the new seeds.
It's a good seed because it's drought resistant. The only thing is that it's not in the market. We look for it and we don't get it when we want it. Yes. It should be put in the shops where we buy other seeds. We end up buying other varieties because we don't find this variety in the shops.
That is not good news given that Zimbabwe's next growing season is expected to begin soon. Zimbabwe Super Seeds, one of the companies distributing the new variety, said it is working to meet farmers' demands. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
Job opportunities are limited for university graduates in Kenya, so some have been creating their own jobs. From Nairobi, Mohamed Yusuf has the story of one enterprising graduate who transformed an old mattress into a growing business.
Lillian Wairimu started this work 4 years ago, and the customers from her custom-made bin bag chairs keep coming in ever-increasing numbers. The idea came to her when she saw an old mattress under her bed. Then came the internet search and the online tutorial that changed her life.
I'm happy to see what began as a desperate means for me to survive has become a living room sensation for the many clients who come to me. I am very happy, and with the many ideas that I also have in my mind, I want to pray for more success in the future. So I'm proud of the business.
But it hasn't been easy. Like many young entrepreneurs in Africa, she didn't have a way to get startup capital. It took her several months to save the $50 she needed to make her first chair. Now she sells her products for $100 to $140, depending on the size. A few companies have placed orders. Individual clients contact her through Facebook from as far away as Rwanda. Word of mouth brings other customers in Nairobi.
I went to her house and I saw a very comfortable thing that didn't look like a chair. It was not a chair. It was not a poof. So I got curious, and she told me to search her Facebook page, and that's why I'm here today.
It takes at least 6 days to make each item.
I've also learned to maximize on quality and not to compromise on that, because the client gets, and also I get satisfaction to know that the client is happy and content with what I have done.
And Wairimu says this is just the beginning. She plans to grow her business throughout the region. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
The United Nations estimates that 200 million girls and women in over 30 countries have undergone female genital mutilation. Somalia has the highest rate recorded by the UN, with about 98% of the country's female population between the ages of 15 and 49 having been subjected to FGM. Although the procedure is illegal in the United States, some girls undergo the procedure in secret. The U.S. state of Minnesota is home to a large number of refugees from Somalia and has a high rate of FGM. VOA's Somali service reporter Sarah Abdi reports.
Many women who underwent the dangerous procedure of female genital mutilation as a young girl in Somalia still live with the pain. Fadumo Afi, a 55-year-old mother of seven who complains of medical problems, remembers how she was mutilated with an unsterilized instrument.
We were a pair of young girls, as young as 6 years old. It was so harmful to us because we did not even have anesthesia after the FGM. We were living in the areas where medication wasn't possible. We couldn't even pee.
Fartoum Wali, another victim of FGM, founded SRON, a non-profit organization that advocates against FGM and deals with the life-threatening medical conditions that result from the practice. Wali underwent the most dangerous type of FGM, known as Step 3, which includes the complete sewing shut off the vagina. She still has emotional scars and suffers from medical complications.
Well, the complication is hard. You have a problem with sexual issues. You have problems of going to see the doctor. So when they're doing the pelvic exam, it really, really hurts.
It's not from our effort. It's from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Female genital mutilation is a traditional practice that has nothing to do with Islam, says Sheikh Hassan Jami'i, a local imam and a father of four daughters.
All scholars of Islam agree that pharaonic FGM is totally prohibited. And that's why I'm proud, as a father of four daughters, never practiced this FGM, and it's harmful. And Islam, there is a principle that says whatever is harmful is prohibited.
The Honeybeam Count Medical Center, a trauma center based in Minneapolis, reports that 99% of Somali women have gone through type 3 genital mutilation. Since the medical complications of female genital mutilation are very severe, even those who undergo surgery will not regain what they have lost. Although there are now numerous campaigns and laws against the procedure in African countries, it is still widely practiced and causes untold problems and pain for women on the continent. Sahra Abdi, VOA News, Minneapolis.
People who live in areas with polluted air increase their risk for developing hypertension, a leading risk factor for the development of heart disease known as high blood pressure. The hypertension study is the largest of its kind to establish the deadly link, VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
The study looked at hypertension in 41,000 people in five different countries, including Norway, Sweden, Denmark, Germany, and Spain, for 5 to 8 years. It's part of the long-term Europe study of cohorts for air pollution effects, known as ESCAPE, which focuses on health problems associated with pollution. At the beginning of the hypertension study, beginning in 2008, none of the participants reported having high blood pressure or taking medicine to control it. By 2011, 6,200 people reported having developed hypertension and started taking blood pressure-lowering drugs. Most lived in urban areas where air pollution is highest. Air pollution is measured in micrograms of particulate matter per cubic meter. The researchers found that for every 5 micrograms per cubic meter of particulate matter, hypertension increased by 1/5 or 22% in people living in the most polluted areas. Epidemiologist Barbara Hoffman works for the Center for Health and Society at Heinrich Heine University in Germany. Dr. Hoffman, who led the study, says many of these cases of high blood pressure could be prevented.
So it is a very important result if you can see that something that you can actually change, I mean, we can actually reduce air pollution, can have such an influence on such an important health outcome.
The findings were published in the European Heart Journal. Hoffman says researchers will now study areas of where pollution is low, looking at the health effects of cleaner air.
But this is, of course, important in terms of regulation, because you would like to regulate the air pollution down to a level where you don't see any effects anymore. So therefore, it's important to really look at areas of low exposure and see how far down can you go until you don't see any effects anymore.
It's believed that air pollution leads to health problems by causing lung inflammation that spreads throughout the body, eventually leading to blood vessel and heart damage. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. A new report from Amnesty International says government forces in South Sudan deliberately killed and raped citizens while UN forces failed to act during clashes in the capital in July. The 5 days of fighting between forces loyal to President Salva Kiir and loyalists of then First Vice President Riek Machar left at least 270 people dead and displaced 36,000 from their homes. The report describes how government forces targeted people based on ethnicity and perceived political loyalties. That's it for this Wednesday, October 26th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, along with our engineer Jimmy Cook, I'm James Barton in Washington saying, have a nice day, Africa.
Hello, Africa music fans. We have hours of the music that you love every day. Some things change, some remain the same. From the north to the south and the east to the west, we play only the best. Tune in at 0100, 0200, 1200 and 1300 UTC, GMT, right here on VOA Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll look at the role of the Washington, D.C. Mayor's Office of African Affairs. We'll discuss the impact of the office as it seeks to improve the quality of life for the District of Columbia's diverse African-born population. That's next, right here on Straight Talk Africa,
at 18:30 UTC.